Hi, and welcome to another podcast from the Cloud Evangelist website. I'm joined today by an old friend, John Masters, and it's quite a pleasure to sit next to him because he left the UK and disappeared off to Pastures Green in the US quite some years ago now. So it's always nice to catch up with him. John, introduce yourself.
Hi, so I'm John Masters, and work at Red Hat in the Red Hat ARM team. Prior to that, I guess I've been involved with the Linux community for 17 years plus at this point.
So the first time I met John was about 12 and a half years ago, when this precocious talent in a dog-tooth jacket approached me with a pad of paper doing an interview for Linux User Magazine for Maggie Mir. Do you remember
that? Yes, I do.
Stamford Bridge. And quite interesting times. I was doing a lot of smoothwall community and open source stuff.
I still write a
really?
Kernel column for them.
No. I was pretty aware of that, actually. Yeah. Okay. So John's been working on some really cool stuff with the ARM project. So do you want to tell us more about what you've been doing?
Yeah, so you know, I'm a fairly big proponent of ARM technology within the company. I think that's a subtle way of putting that. But in the broader sense, my interest these days is hyperscale computing.
Mm-hmm.
Cloud computing as well, but hyperscale in particular, where you're looking at this point of inflection in the industry where we move away from traditional server systems, traditional blade systems, to designs where we're leveraging, or we're starting to leverage, the mobile computing space. So we're taking the level of integration that you have in a cell phone, where you have a single SoC, a single system on chip, and now server on chip solution. You have your CPU, you have your IO devices, you have everything on one piece of silicon. And to make a complete server system, you need one chip. External to that, you need some memory and you need some storage.
Mm-hmm.
That's a server. And the level of density you can get by just cramming these chips into a chassis, well, a newly designed chassis, because we've got a lot of other things to take care of in the course of redesigning this, is phenomenal. So second to that, these systems are very low energy. So mm-hmm. you get very high density, you get very low energy computing. And it's really about not trying to go for the maximum performance in terms of individual core compute power.
Mm-hmm.
It's really saying, in aggregate, I'm going to get more performance, but I'm going to use a lot less energy. And we're talking 5 watts per chip, not hundreds.
So I spent time out in Boston at Summit with the ARM guys, who are pumped up about the fact that, you know, Red Hat take them very seriously in the work that they're doing and the engineering work, the prowess that they're showing. But where, you know, we witnessed you in Lycra on a bike powering an HPC cluster, which was quite cool.
Yeah, I wanted to make a kind of gimmicky PR statement, but also, you know, serious point about low energy. It's, you know, hyperscale computing, and it's not just ARM. There's also some very interesting Intel Atom-based designs as well, and you know, may the best man win there. I think really
mm-hmm.
is the truth of that. But what I wanted to do was to say, you know, I can take a bicycle, attach a generator to it, as I did, and it did work. It was a real. People said, was that staged? No, it was real. It was a bicycle hooked to a generator attached to various inversion equipment and whatever, and I was running a real server doing real workloads off that. And
I think what we'll do is I'll actually put the YouTube video link to this article so people can actually see you in Lycra. You'd be famous for all the wrong reasons.
I enjoyed the comments on the blogs there, because you know I used to be a much larger guy, and I'm not as large anymore, but I've still got a little ways to go. And someone commented saying, "Wow, that guy looks out of shape."
Really?
the guy who commented his picture wasn't exactly flattering. And then there was a whole dialogue of people saying, "Yeah, well, you know, you can talk, man."
I think it's quite exciting, because if you think about hyperscale computing, it's where industry is going to be in 5 years' time, and we've really got an opportunity to make a difference. But I think it's going to be the companies who throw investment at it now, both in people and technology, and also in commitment to actually understand where we need to be, and those who don't are going to be left by the wayside.
Well, I think the thing is that you know, we're talking very much about cloud computing and virtualization. And a few years back, virtualization was the big thing. Now it's all cloud, right? Now we're all up in
very fluffy.
The fluffy atmosphere, right? And that's wonderful. And, you know, cloud is a great word and we can use it a lot. But I think things like hyperscale are 5 years from now or 3 to 5 years from now. They're already here today, but the sort of true value of that level of integration is that next step that's coming in the next few years. And you know, we need to look to the future. We need to say, okay, 3 to 5 years from now, everything we're talking about today in terms of cloud computing is just a given. It's just that's a baseline. We're looking towards, you know, the level of mass integration that's going to follow and what that will mean. Because you're starting to look at some of these interesting use cases. We were talking earlier before this interview about you know, things like Hadoop clusters, and you know, the if you look at some of the reports now, there was an article in the New York Times recently about how it's now feasible to effectively digitally record everything everyone ever does in their life. On a matter of I think it was 2 cents a year.
Yeah.
Within 5 years, right? It's going to be 2 cents a year. So, you know, the article was actually about how authoritarian governments can leverage technology. But you know, let's put that issue to one side for a second and just think about what that means when you can record that much data about people,
and, sure,
and what that will mean for, you know, marketeers, for companies out there. Everyone is going to want to have a Hadoop cluster running to, you know, trawl through Facebook and Twitter and social media. And, you know, I've got product XYZ I'm looking to sell. Mm-hmm. And I would like to go and crank through and see how that's going to impact the market.
And to be able to do that as quickly as possible and as cost effectively as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that Hadoop done properly is hugely exciting. However, a lot of the Hadoop clusters that I've seen deployed out there, I wouldn't say they're a hobbyist, but I think there's a fine line between people who, back in the day, they're the sort of people who deploy Caldera Linux and just deploy it out there as a server. It's quite funny because I came to Red Hat back into the open source community from working in very much the intelligence and the military field as an accreditor. And it was scary. You'd go and find a server, and the server would have Firefox and OpenOffice on it. You'd say, well, this isn't a server. You've left Telnet open. And we're seeing the same with Hadoop. Mm-hmm. It's the same type of thing. And there are very large insurance companies and very large banks and building societies who are now looking at Hadoop seriously. And correctly, they're going out to universities and reaching out for the best talent to help them achieve that. And I think a lot of the degree courses in the UK now, and also in the US, are arming their postgraduate students with those skills that they need to be able to go out there and talk about clustering.
Well, I think if we just take it back to doing a solution, quote unquote, properly, I think one of the problems I've seen with the emerging, not just ARM space, but hyperscale space as well, is it's like with cloud. Anybody can talk cloud or talk virtualization or talk you know, hyperscale computing or ARM-based servers, but talking and doing it right are two different things. And I'm seeing a lot of solutions out there where, you know, the solution isn't how I would have it for enterprise grade quality offering. Uh-huh. And I think that's one of the areas where not just Red Hat but some of these other players can come in, and we can start to, you know, really look to how can you make these you know, more of a high quality enterprise offering.
So if we start thinking about the miniaturization technology and getting more bang for your buck, as people start to understand how hyperscale is going to make such a huge dramatic, in, you know, when Blade came along, mm-hmm. people were getting more bang for the buck. They could get more CPUs in one chassis. Hyperscale again is going to revolutionize that.
So you'll have in the next couple of, well, so today you can have 288 systems in 4U of space.
Explain what a system is for those listening.
Yeah, so a system or a node in this case is, for example, a quad-core single chip with some memory and some storage. Mm-hmm. And you can have 288 of those in 4U of rack space.
Which is huge.
But that's today. And that's before we've really put a lot more effort into the miniaturization and the integration. I think you're going to find 10 times the number of servers per rack in the coming years, right?
So from a power consumption and green perspective, it's enormous.
Yeah.
But also from a data crunching and shared capacity, it's enormous as well.
Well, on the other side of it, actually, if you look at the way the integration goes, what you start to do is you start to integrate things like fabrics, and you start to kill off the need for discrete networking as well between systems. So what's going to happen is you will in your data center or whatever your environment is, you know, you'll buy these chassis that contain, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 nodes, individual systems, if you like, that communicate with each other. Today they're quad core. In the next year or so, they'll start to be 8, 16, 32 core. They're not wimpy systems at that point, but they are very low energy.
So it's challenging Moore's law, isn't it? Completely.
It is challenging.
Out the water.
It is challenging, and it's talking about scale out as the solution to that.
Yeah.
Because if you look at Moore's law, you know, I like to keep some of these figures in my head. If you look in the last 20 years, there was a 52% year-on-year growth curve, which was fueled by silicon process improvements, by a lot of the changes we were seeing in terms of, you know, CPU pipeline design, all these things. So they could cheat. They could get you 52% year-on-year growth.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the revolution of the last 20 years has come from. Now, if you look in the last 4 or 5 years, that's dropped down to, I think it's 22% and falling, because there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
So now you've got to look at scale out, you've got to look at some of these new solutions to solve that problem.
But it also puts challenges on being able to do a lot of this stuff in software. You've got the guys who behind OpenFlow who've realized that you can get away from traditional chassis. You don't need to have the routers and the switches. You can do it all in software.
Yeah.
But it then puts the onus on the operating system layer tier and all those the complexities that we need to be able to think of from a Linux enterprise perspective. How do we best address doing this technology in hyperscale?
One of the biggest issues there is management, because with these systems, there are two novel concepts, I think, that need to be sort of espoused. One is failure in place.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have 10,000 systems in a rack or more, what you can start to do is treat them as disk blocks or pixels on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
Because if one of those systems fails, there's absolutely no value or point in sending a service engineer out to fix it. If 100 of those systems fail, that's still a very small percentage, and you don't care. So what you want to do is you want to have failure in place. You want to basically mark these systems as bad. They're bad disk blocks, if you like, bad flash sectors, whatever your analogy is, bad pixels, and you say, okay, well, a certain percentage is fine before I replace the whole system.
You realize you're describing Tron.
I am describing Tron. You know, the future is now, right?
I was going to say, that's the best way of describing it.
If you can get me my light bike, I am very, very happy, right? So there's that, but then there's also the management side of it, which is talking about rather than having 10,000 systems, when you turn them on and they all, as a thundering herd, say, give me my bits, I need to boot right now. What you want to do is you want to be able to inject those pieces. And each of these systems we're seeing, not only are they quad-core and up, custom designed server chips, but they also have management controllers built in.
Mm-hmm.
So each one, I can have very specific control over what it's doing. And I can say, I'm going to inject your operating system remotely rather than have you boot up and start asking for bits.
Mm-hmm. So it's changing the whole paradigm shift of the traditional model of management, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to then have a knock-on effect with a lot of the supporting architects and environments that we take as a given today.
And I think the other side of that is that we're trying to go back to these standards organizations. And one thing I spend a lot of my time doing, actually, is working with different standards groups, trying to, not just standardize the emerging ARM server space, which is important, but also standardize some of the hyperscale pieces, because we will need to have very industry standard means to manage these.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really get away when you've got that level of system count with having one vendor solution approaches. You need to have completely open standards that allow for transparent management of different vendor solutions at the same time.
Okay, so you're a bit of a book reader.
I've been called that.
Well, yeah, you do have a veritable library of chuff, I would say. You have every process architecture book going. A lot of the people who listen to these podcasts, they're just starting out in their careers, or maybe they're undergraduates or postgraduates.
Yeah.
If you were the Oracle looking forward 3 to 5 years, where should these guys be looking at putting some of their talents, or what they should be looking at researching as part and parcel of their doctorates or their careers?
If you're interested in learning about computer architecture and where some of that stuff is going, you could do a lot worse than looking at OpenRisk, which is another side pet project of mine.
Okay.
OpenRisk is a completely open source computer architecture. You can buy a couple hundred dollar inexpensive FPGA board, which is a little board that lets you take your CPU design and test it without making the chip. And you can buy that. The design is even open. You can download effectively the source code to the computer architecture. You can put that into this environment. You can test this out. You can make changes to the CPU design. You then have a completely open toolchain, a completely open kernel, and you can start to build your own system-on-chip-based solutions using these pieces. And in fact, I play with this myself. Whilst you can go and you can look at ARM and you can look at x86 and you can leverage some of these designs that are out there, if you really want to understand how they work, these days you can actually go and you can really understand how these kinds of technologies work by building them yourself at home. And if you want to learn about how some of these optimizations work, you could do a lot worse than doing that. And of course, keeping up with the rest of the technology space as well.
Okay. So the emergence of things like Raspberry Pi, they're putting a hobbyist environment back into the educational arena, but also extending the ability for more people to get involved with Linux and open source, and that's got to be a positive thing. If you think about where we came from, and we've had careers in Linux and open source since, I think it's 16 years for me now, so I don't know what I do to fill up on. But again, Raspberry Pi has seen this huge groundswell of opinion and a lot of people who are now understanding that computing doesn't have to be hobbyist, it can be something that's extending their own abilities, and that's got to be positive.
Well, I think one of the things that I look back on and say, well, I'm 30 now, and I've been doing this for 17 years.
Yeah.
And I pointed out to one of my colleagues a while back that
you're 30.
I'm 30 now.
Jeez, I'm 40 and 50.
I pointed out that I don't know. I've never really known anything other than open source and Linux because I've now been doing it more than half my life. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure at some point there are always these trends in the industry. There may be something else, right?
Yeah.
Open source will still exist, but maybe something will displace Linux. Who knows? It'll be interesting for me and others trying to adapt to that. But when I was starting this, you still had older PC designs with ISA buses and circuits you could look at and you could understand. One of the problems we have today is this level of mass integration means that it's very, very difficult for someone coming into this to understand how things work.
Yep.
Take a PC today, you've got your PCI Express backplanes and all this stuff. Well, people don't really, it's very hard for a kid to understand packetized serial buses. But things like Raspberry Pi and some of this technology that's very inexpensive, low cost, a kid can buy this or a parent can buy it for a kid and they can start to understand some of these components. You can use later on things like OpenRisk and some of these other projects to start to dissect and understand how these systems
are built. I think it's very important to say that Raspberry Pi is not the only approach. However, it's a very healthy one.
It is. Yeah. It is. And I think Eben and the crew have done a really good job because, again, it's when we got into this, it was because we had inexpensive BBC microcomputers back in the day in the UK and PCs and whatever, and being able to open it up and play with it. And I think it's very important.
Hang on, you're 30. So I started programming on a ZX81, which was the year before you were born.
That's right.
Okay. That's Sinclair Timex for you guys.
So I guess I started 6502 coding when I was 6 or 7.
I was about 8 when I started on ZX81. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Raspberry Pi is enabling the people who we took for granted. You took a PC and you plugged it into a UHF port or VHF port on your television. Raspberry Pi is the same with HDMI today.
Yep.
And for me, I'm starting to see friends who, traditional Microsoft skill friends who are now building their own little Raspberry Pi boxes and doing XBMC and cool stuff at home.
Well, let me tell you the other thing that really interests me there is I bought my ticket for the Open Hardware Summit. So it's the third year of the Open Hardware Summit this year in New York. And a little plug for them because it's an open event. That's the 27th of September, I think, this year. And Open Hardware Summit is very interesting because you get a lot of these things like Raspberry Pi,
Arduino,
they've all the key guys from these projects have spoken, but you get a lot of open hardware hackers. You get kids, which is great. You get a disproportionate number of women as well, which is wonderful, because you get a very different dynamic and a very different demographic of people who are very interested in the technology and want to get more involved.
Yeah.
And, that's wonderful. I think events like this are very important to have people come into our space that we live in and understand and get increasingly involved.
So I've spent the last 10 years of my own time going out to schools and colleges and sixth form colleges talking about Linux and open source, and I go in there and it's free. And I get these looks of incredulity. But about 2-3 months ago, I got approached at a trade show by a guy in his late 20s who came up to me and said, you don't remember me? And I was like, no. And he said, in 2000, you came to my college, Peter Simmons College in Winchester, and you talked about Linux and you left Red Hat disks behind. I'd never used Linux and open source before. And I said, oh, that's really cool. And I said, what do you do now? And he said, well, I head up the Linux services for HP in Grenoble in France.
Yes.
And, there's at least 2 or 3 guys, John Fortley and Tom Ellis, who've been through Red Hat, who I picked out of school when they were 14, 15 to write man fast for Smoothwall. And it's enabling us, I think, to at least put some power back into impoverished ICT departments to be able to say to these school children, there is a technology outside PowerPoint and Excel. Mm-hmm. Please think about what you can. I do this stock thing where I sit in front of a classroom of kids and I say to them, who here uses a computer? And they all put their hands up. And then I said, do you understand what use means?
Yes.
Do you use a computer or does the computer use you?
Yes.
And one hand goes up, the guy who installed Ubuntu or Slackware or
But I think beyond that, we're seeing this move into more mobile computing and tablets and whatever. My nephew, he uses a little netbook, but for him, tablets and phones and touch interfaces are what he wants to do. And
mm-hmm.
My brother-in-law and sister have been saying that he plays too many games. And actually, I started talking to him about, would you like to write games?
Yeah.
And he thought, oh, that's interesting. That's cool. And I think that can go places. But I think also you want to look at where kids these days can get their kicks. We used to get our kicks from writing little 8-bit sprites and games.
Sure, yeah.
It's very hard for someone to do that today because the games are so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can buy an Arduino or some kind of open source hardware that's very, it's lower end, but you could make like a desk lamp that's connected to Twitter and you can tweet to it. Well, you can actually build these very quickly and very easily. And I think that's the way that we're going to get kids and young people increasingly interested in open source, is by building these gadgets and getting in on the periphery and playing with these technologies. And then they'll become kernel hackers later on. But I don't think you're going to see quite the same way that we got into
exactly.
in the future.
But for those people who are listening and need to know more, where should they be looking online?
To learn more about hyperscale computing?
Just from an entry point.
Point.
Where should they be looking?
It's a very interesting question.
Well, you're the guru, you're the oracle, you've got the answers.
Yeah.
I'm not holding a gun to your head.
No, this is one of the problems, is that it is increasingly hard to get this entry-level information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say if you're looking just to get involved in Linux, there's certainly still Linux user groups are one good way to get involved.
Sure.
Getting online and reading some of the books are very important. We do actually have a sort of failure these days of keeping some of this information up to date. As some of us have gotten more involved,
I know. I think it's quite a shame that things like the One Laptop Per Child project have seemed to slow down, and there's been a complete de-amplification of all the noise around that. But there's still the Linux Terminal Server project out there, and there's still a lot of projects out there, especially in the education space. So I'm going to be doing a podcast in a couple of weeks' time with Robin, talking about how we can do things better with Fedora and talking about cloud, but also increasing that pushback out to the community. I think that's all going to be healthy stuff.
If you want to get involved, two things I think are very useful. If you're looking to get involved in some kind of hardware-based effort, something like the Raspberry Pi is a very good way to do that. RaspberryPi.org. You can buy one for about $30. I don't actually know how much they're going for.
They're at £22 here.
£22.
From RS, yeah.
That's one very good way to do that. You can obviously get your favorite Linux distribution. I use Fedora. People use other distros as well. You can download that and get involved. But there are a number of different ways to get started. I do think that we need to do a better job in remembering that It was different for us getting into it.
Yeah.
And the world has moved on, and we need to continue to encourage people to get involved.
I think it's where the next lifeblood of, you know, the IT industry is coming from. It does worry me that in North America and also in the developed world, in Europe, it just seems to be we're turning out people who have very low IT skills, yep. or people who go through an IT degree and then come out as pen testers. They can run Nmap or Nessus or whatever.
Well, I actually ran a survey when I finished school, and I'm a little arrogant and egotistical, and I'm trying to get better. But I ran a survey, and I sent this questionnaire out, actually, and I asked some graduates if they could explain some fundamental computer science concepts, things like what's a stack. And I had a very surprisingly high number of people did not know what a stack was, and they had a computer science degree.
Yeah.
And that's disturbing and scary. So you need to look at this and say, how do we get this next generation? Because the next generation, frankly, they're not going to be looking to do kernel hacking.
No.
They're not doing that level, actually. I think you know, we want to encourage the higher level. We want to make it exciting and interesting to get involved in programming and in developing systems. But we need to accept that, you know, newcomers now are far more interested in Web 2.0 technologies
I think Red Hat is also starting to do something about that now by accident, in the respect that we have OpenShift,
mm-hmm.
which enables people who've got basic Python, PHP, Ruby skills to be able to, you know, sign up for a free account in three clicks. GitHub is your friend, and off to the cloud you go.
And I did, in fact, sign up, and I've only played very briefly, because one of the problems is you don't want to turn into that old guy, that fuddy-duddy. You're like, well, what's this web thing, right?
So
I'm sort of in that space myself now, where I'm saying, this is really cool technology. I understand how it works. If you want to talk about how it works at the register
level, that's fine.
If you want to talk about how it works at the web level, well, I'm a little bit more hand-wavy. And I want to fix that, because, again, I think that's where the newcomers now are really energized and really getting involved.
I did a talk at University of West of England in Bristol about 2 months ago. They do a thing called an IT Mega Meet once a year, and talking about Python, talking about bits and pieces, and I did the whole Red Hat open source, you know, where I've come from, but also where Red Hat are going, and mentioned OpenShift, and they've been talking about Python from a mobile application, the SDK type approach. And in 15 minutes in a break, people were who'd never heard of OpenShift were signing up accounts and firing off their applications. And it should be more than WordPress and Drupal. That's the basic stuff.
Well, I think the true value of this, these technologies, actually, is that you can remove the infrastructure cost.
Yeah.
So when we got involved, when I was getting involved,
you had to go have
a server, you had to go get a computer, you had to install it, Now it's sort of, it's wonderful. I meet people in coffee shops, friends of mine. It never even remotely occurs to them that they'd have to install a server.
No.
It's just, oh, I'll have 10,000 servers. Well, when we were starting out, getting 10,000 servers was a serious proposition.
Well, it still is a serious proposition in some avenues. And, you know, for those guys who are still from the sort of Visual Basic .NET world, it still is.
Yes.
Because they're being left behind.
They are being left behind.
And my worry is, you know, if you want to extend your career, you should be talking and understanding what open source can mean to you, not just from a career perspective, but also from a technology perspective.
That's true. I think that's true.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Thank you very much, Richard.
And I think what we're going to do probably next time is I'm going to be stateside, and we'll talk with a little bit more passion on my hyperscale.
Very good.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye, mate.